Morning, everyone. I think you all know me. I'm Etienne. Hi. And I'll be preaching this morning. We're busy with a series on what I wish they told me about God. So everyone's sharing something that they didn't know about God back in the day. So what I felt pressed in my heart is to share just how in control God is. Now, what we have to do is, as part of the series, we have to show a picture of us before we had this revelation. So the picture of me is, there we go. This is actually quite a significant picture. This was taken in 1998. I'm in control of the cup of coffee, definitely. This was in Namibia. Unlike Kenny's story, not me on a mission, just me going on a tour with a couple of friends. And this is significant because this is the last year, this is the year in which I gave my life to the Lord. So at the end of this year, I got saved and I became a Christian. So at this point, I knew very little, actually. At this point, I thought I was a Christian. And I actually got saved end of that year by going on missions. We had what we call strandings, there you go to like a town and you spend the whole like 2-3 weeks there and you just do whatever outreaches. And I went there thinking I'm going to go do missions, and I actually got saved in like the first preparation weekend. So since then, God has walked a path with me, and I've learned a lot about just how in control God is. And it's coming up on almost 20 years now that I've walked with the Lord. And the advantage of that is you see and experience, actually, the things you read about in the Bible. And you have testimonies of how in control God is. And you get to see the bigger picture. You get to see, okay, this is why this thing happened 5 years ago. And this is what it's led to now. So God has worked a lot in me. And just to get to know Him and get to know how in control He is. But the reason I felt pressed to do a sermon on this, it's because really it's really come to a head in the last year or so, just because of a situation in my family. And I'm going to share just a little bit of a short background. It's about my sister and her husband, basically. They got married in 2003. Things started off just fine, but it got worse, and it's been bad for quite a while. He used to like to drink. Drinking became more and more of a problem. I don't want to go into the details of it. I don't want to expose them. But things got pretty bad between them. And there would be like a flare-up, and then everybody would react, and then it'd go quiet for a while, and the flare-up. But you'd also always knew there's something that wasn't right. Things aren't going well there. And then to the point last year where my sister just had enough, she decided she wants to get a divorce now. And this is really, this is something that's been happening in our family that I've been praying about for quite a while, but I had no control over. So God has really worked in me about the fact that He's actually in control of that situation. And I'll share a bit more on it as we go, as we work through the sermon. But yeah, it's really made me confront a lot of things about whether God is in control or not, what to do in these situations. And it's interesting that I picked this topic about probably more than a month ago when we decided on this series. And obviously, it's all of a sudden become very relevant to this country. So if you go to the next slide, these are a few of the headlines just from the past month. South African currency plunges after Jacob Zuma fires finance minister. You can read through them. You've all been faced with this day after day, and it feels like it's too big for us. Your immediate reaction is, what am I going to do? I've got to go do something. I've got to run and do something. And there's lots of ways you can react to that, obviously. It's not just South Africa. In Cape Town, everyone driving on the N1, N2 sees that signboards, 100 days of water left. What am I going to do? What can we do about that? You reduce your water consumption. The rest of Cape Town doesn't really care. You're not in control of it. The signboards aren't really making a difference, I think. So what are we going to do? And we all face these situations in our lives where it just seems too big for us. It seems outside of our control. And again, there's lots of ways we can react to it. But what we want to find out is what is a godly way to react to it? What's a biblical way to react to these things happening in our lives? So we can go to the next slide. Yeah, so that is the question. We get faced with these things all the time, but how should we react? What is the biblical way to react to it? So what I want to do is I want to share a bit about what God is, the journey God has taken me through, and I'm still pretty much in the middle of this journey. I wish I could stand here today and give you a testimony about how things worked out with my brother and with my sister and her husband, but I'm pretty much still in the middle of it. And as the deadline of the sermon came closer and closer, I kept thinking, okay, God's going to come through, God's going to come through, so I can stand here with a testimony. But I think it's good that I don't stand here with a full testimony, because a lot of times we're in the middle of it, and we need to know how to react when we're in the middle of it, not necessarily at the other end of it. So I still believe there will be a testimony. What actually happened was, if I can maybe go into a bit more detail about what happened, is things got bad last year to the point that my brother-in-law, who had lost my number, he changed phones, woke up one morning and just felt he had to contact me, and didn't have my number, so he remembered Susan works at the Mount Nelson, looked up the Mount Nelson's number so he could phone Susan so he can get my number so he can get into contact with me. Came to see me that that afternoon and basically gave his life to the Lord. And I thought, yes, here's the testimony. And I wish I could tell you that everything went fine from there, but actually everything went worse from there. It just completely tanked. So, but God is working. I'm still in the middle of this testimony. And I trust I'm going to stand here at one point and give you the full testimony. I'm looking forward to that. And to be honest, it's a little bit scary to stand here and say that to you, because what if things don't work out? I'm going to look like a fool. I stood here and said, God is going to give me this testimony, and I'm going to have to come back and say, well, maybe not. But those who trust in the Lord shall not be put to shame. So I'm actually glad I'm standing here, not with a full testimony, because it takes more faith, and I want to encourage you to have that as well. So what I want to do is I want to look at the book of Esther, and I'm going to go into quite a bit of detail, just because you can see God's control in the detail of what happened there. So just to give you a quick background, this takes place after the exile. So the Israelites were exiled to Babylon during the Babylonian conquest of the country of Israel, and then the Babylonians were conquered by the Persians, and so there was a new sheriff in town, a new king, ruler, and the Persians allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem, but a lot of them stayed behind. So Esther is one of those who stayed behind. So it starts with a big party. As the king of that time is King Xerxes, and he had a big party just to celebrate his kingdom, and it was like, I think it was almost like a year, and he told people they can drink as much as they want, there must be no limits on what they can drink. And he obviously privately hosted quite a few more prominent men. And at the same time, his wife, Queen Vashti, also hosted a lot of women. So later on in the party, when King Xerxes was pretty drunk, he calls for Queen Vashti. Basically, he wants to show his friends what a hot wife he has. So I don't blame him for that. I can relate. So I'm not going to blame the guy. So he calls for Queen Vashti, and she refuses to come. She's not having none of this. She says, no. So the king loses it, and he goes to his advisors and says, he's shaking, he's so angry, what shall I do? And his advisors say to him, listen here, you've got to nip this in the bud. If word gets out that this is how the queen treated you, then in every single household throughout your empire, wives are going to treat their husbands like that as well. This is not just about you. You've got to make a plan here. So they said to them, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked, King Xerxes was very strong about following the law of the Medes and the Persians. You must declare that she be banished from your presence and she not be made queen anymore. And then you'll send a declaration throughout the whole of the kingdom. This is what happened. And wives, this is how you ought to treat your husbands. So this is what happens. Queen Vashti is gone. So after she's gone, the king's like, okay, well, now I need to make to replace her. So this is his brilliant plan. He sends for women throughout all of the provinces of his kingdom. And they come together, and they're given 12 months, I'm not kidding you, 12 months of beauty treatment, each and every one of them. And at the end of the 12 months, they go into the king for one night. And after that, they go into the second harem, and there they stay forever, unless the king specifically calls for them by name. So it's not a great deal, I guess, not what you envision for yourself when you decide you want to be a wife, but that's what happened. So one of the women who was chosen was a woman called Esther. Now, Esther was a cousin of a man called Mordecai, who's quite a bit older than her, and he raised her actually as one of his own daughters. So he said to her, though, don't tell them you're Jewish. So she goes into this whole Miss Persia contest that's going on. And she doesn't tell anybody that she's Jewish. And when it's her time to go into the king is really pleased with her and decides he's going to make her queen. Because there we go. Vashti is gone, Esther is queen. The next bit almost seems like a bit of a side story, but anyway, Mordecai then overhears two people plotting to assassinate the king. So he goes to Esther with it. Esther informs the king. The king makes an inquiry. He finds that it's true, and what happens then gets written into the chronicles of the king. Now we've got another player, Haman, who arrives on the scene. He was one of the officials of Xerxes, and Xerxes was very pleased with him. So he promoted him and sort of said that everyone had to honor him. So everywhere he went, people would bow down to him and show him lots of respect. But Mordecai refused. He wouldn't bow down to him. He wouldn't respect him. And this Haman lost it. He doesn't matter that everybody else honors him. The fact that this one guy doesn't honor him completely floors him. And he says, it's not just enough for me to take out Mordecai. I'm going to take out everyone of his race. I'm going to take out the Jews. I'm not going to just take out this guy. I can take him out easily. I'm going to take out all the Jews. So he concocts this plot where he goes to King Xerxes and convinces him. He says to him, look, there's this group of people throughout your kingdom who refuse to conform to your ways. They keep themselves separate. You've got to deal with this. Issue a decree that these people be killed, basically wiped off the face of the earth. So this was in about April of that year. So Haman and his friend cast lots to see when he must take his revenge on Mordecai, and it fell on March of the next year. So he got the king to issue a decree that in March of the next year, anybody who wishes can for one day on the specific date go out and kill any Jews they want to and take their possessions. So basically he gives license to the enemies of the Jews to take them out, or people who even weren't the enemies just wanted their goods, to kill them and plunder their goods. So Mordecai obviously hears about this and he starts mourning and he tears his clothes, he puts on sackcloth, and he starts walking through the city crying and wailing, and eventually gets to the palace gates. Now the law was nobody who was mourning or in sackcloth was allowed inside the palace gates. So he just stands outside the gates crying. So Queen Esther was, I don't know where she was back then. Queen Esther sends somebody to find out what's going on. So Mordecai tells her about this decree, and he asks her, can you please go to the king and just plead on our behalf? So I want to read actually a bit from Esther 4 verse 10. Then Esther spoke to Hatach and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one whom the king holds out his golden scepter that they may live. Yet I have not been called to go to the king in these 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have been, whether you have come to the kingdom for a time such as this?" Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night and day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. So then at the end of these 3 days, after having prayed and fasted for 3 days, she goes into the king's court and he holds out his scepter, says, you are welcome, you're allowed here. And he asks her, what is her request? And she says, if it pleases the king, that the king and Haman come to a banquet at my place. So the king goes, and they go to the banquet, and the king asks her, okay, we're here now. What do you really want? So he says, she says to him, oh, just come again tomorrow, and I'll tell you then what I want. So obviously Haman already thinks he's the cat's whiskers. Now he gets invites, just him and the king, to the queen for a banquet. And he walks out there like really, I mean, if his ego was big, it was really big now. And he's up on cloud nine and he walks out and there's Mordecai again, not respecting him. And he goes from cloud nine to down in the dumps because of this guy who doesn't respect him. So he goes to his house and he calls his wife and his friends. And first he brags about how awesome he is and how rich he is and how much the king honors him and how he went to the banquet. And he says to them, all this means nothing as long as this Mordecai person is alive. So this is his wife's advice to him. Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. So the next day, so that evening actually, the king couldn't sleep, so he's tossing and turning. So he tells his servants to go get the chronicle so he can read through them. And he reads in there that what Mordecai did for the plot that he found out about the king's assassination. And he asks, what was done for Mordecai? And the people and the servants said, no, nothing was done for him. So at that point, Haman comes in. So king's, Haman's here. Haman, come here. What shall we do for somebody who really pleases the king? And Haman's like, yes, that's me. So let me just get to the right place. And Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback throughout the city square and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. So then the king says to him, that's Haman, that's an awesome idea. I want you to go and go do that for Mordecai. So, sorry, Haman, it's not going to work out for you in the story. So he goes and does that. He puts them on the horse. Haman has to lead him throughout the city saying, this is what the king does for someone delights in. Okay, so the next day, the king and Haman went to dinner to dine with Esther. And the king asked her again, okay, we're here now. Tell me what you want. And I'm reading from Esther 7, verse 3. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we had been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. So King Xerxes answered and said to Queen Esther, who is he, and where is he, who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is the wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil is determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden to the palace, to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house? As the words left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now one of the eunuchs said to the king, look, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him on it. So Haman, who plotted this great destruction, gets hanged on the very thing that he made. So it still leaves the Jews in a difficult position, because the a decree issued according to the law could not be revoked. So Esther still went to the king and said, listen, what my people are going to perish. So the king issues another decree saying that on that same day, the Jews are allowed to defend themselves and to take revenge against anybody who tries to attack them. So what happens then is actually on the day in March where the enemies were supposed to destroy the Jews end up destroying their enemies, but they didn't take any plunder. So what the decree that was supposed to end the Jews actually helped the Jews rid themselves of their enemies. So we're going to go through that and just sort of see what can we learn from that and what has God taught me and what I've been going through. And the first thing is to get your head out of the sand. Now, for Queen Esther, she must have felt pretty safe in the palace. She was the queen, and she must have thought to herself, this thing is terrible, but the temptation must have been to just, I'll be fine in the palace, this is not going to touch me. But the reality is, that wasn't true. It would have touched her eventually. And for me, it was the same thing. Now, things are, Susan and I have, we've got baby challenges compared to what other people face. We have a good family life, a good marriage, good jobs. We don't really have a lot of things. Our family life is pretty stable. You know, sure it's rough raising twins, but you know, that's normal parenting rough. That's not things out of control rough. So the temptation for me for a long time was just to stick my head in the sand. You know, I knew this thing was happening with my sister and her husband. And when there was a flare-up, my mom would phone me and we'd talk about it and I'd pray. But while it was quiet, I would just, for a long time, just ignore it. And the temptation is for us as well to do that, to not face what's happening. And the temptation is now in the country as well. Now, a lot of these things that's happening, if it reaches its conclusion, we're not the people who's going to be affected the worst. It's going to touch us, yes. But our temptation is that we'll actually still be okay. It'll hurt a bit, but you know, I read something about this whole Russian nuclear power deal. I don't know if you're aware of that, but rumor is that a big reason for the cabinet reshuffle is to get sign off on this deal, which Robin Gordon refused to sign off. And I read that if that happens, the debt this country will get into to pay for that nuclear facility we don't need, it will be one that cripples, will take a generation to recover, and it'll push millions of people under the poverty line. Now, most of us here will not be pushed under the poverty line. It'll hurt us. So the temptation is that it's rough, but we'll be okay. I don't want to deal with this. But there's two reasons why that is wrong. Firstly, it's not true that it won't affect us. You know, when I was putting my head in the sand, not facing what's happening in my family's life, in my sister's life, it didn't make it go away. And it actually brought it to a place where it's close to exploding now. So ignoring it is not going to protect you. Ignoring it in this country is not going to protect you. It will touch us. It'll touch the poorest of the poor first, but it's going to touch us as well eventually. That's one reason, but the more important reason, I don't want to focus on that one. The second reason is is what Mordecai said to Esther, is, who knows if you were placed where you were for a time such as this. So Esther wasn't placed in the palace as a queen to be safe and to be comfortable. God had positioned her there for that very moment in time so she could go and save the Jews. That's why she was there, not to be safe from what was happening outside. And the same applies to us. You know, Susan and I have discussed a few times, you know, people in this church have gone through rough things, really rough things. And we haven't really gone through any rough things. And I think the reason for that is sometimes we're placed in a seemingly comfortable position, not to be comfortable, but to give us capacity to step up in other areas. So for instance, if Susan and I had been having a tough marriage, it would be difficult for me to step up in my sister and her husband's marriage, to stand in the breach and to actually pray for them and deal with that. I would be too busy trying to deal with my own things. So if we're in a good place, it's not for us to be comfortable. If you're in a good place now, you must actually ask God, where is it that you've called me to step into? What is it that you open my eyes to where you want me to step into? Second thing I learned is that I'm not in control. Not in control of this bottle of water either. That's better. I'm not used to talking this much. Ask Susan. So Esther was not in control either at that point. She hadn't been called to the king for like 30 days. So it wasn't like things were going great between them, and they were like these two little, like a young in love couple or anything, like these two in front here. The king hadn't seen her for 30 days, so it wasn't like she had the king around her little pinky. She wasn't in control of that situation. You know, Vashti wanted to take control of that situation, and it didn't work out too well for her. And you've got to ask yourself, what would have happened if Esther had tried to take control of the situation? If she just immediately stormed into the king and said, you know, my people are going to get killed, and made a big scene and tried to manipulate the king or try and control the king to do what she wanted to do. It would probably have backfired. And that's what I learned. With what's happening with my sister and her husband, I try to take control of the situation quite often. Like I say, he came to me actually, and we actually, funny enough, have more of a relationship now than we've ever had. So I've a place to speak into his life, and there were nights where he lost his temper completely. And I don't want to go into details, but I do want to just say he's never hit my sister or any of the children. So I just want to make that disclaimer. But I would literally have like an hour-long WhatsApp conversation to try and calm him down and try to change his thinking. And you know, what I found is that maybe I could calm him down, or I can get him to think more clearly or straight. And then my sister would say something which he would just, the next day, and he just loses it all over again. Say something that was completely innocent. He just sees it through a specific lens. So all of my attempts at control just didn't work. I wasn't in control of the situation. I wasn't in control of him, how he was thinking, what he was going to do, what they were going to do. I even, at some point, I did like a couple of, tried to do a couple of counseling sessions with him where I sat them down, tried to get them just to talk to each other, to talk through things. Didn't work. And tell you what, when you accept this, there's a lot of peace in that. Because we take on burdens that's not meant for us. We take on something that's not meant for us to control. And now the same applies in this country. You know, when these things happen, the first thing we want to do is, what are we going to do? We must do something. We must organize. And just get me straight, I'm not saying that we mustn't do anything. I'm not saying don't go march or protest. None of these things is bad. But none of these things is going to save this country. No political party is going to save this country. No economic reform is going to save this country. Only God is in control of this country. Which brings me to the second point is, do not place your trust in man. I'm going to read from Isaiah 30, verse 1 to 5, which is a prophecy given to King Hezekiah at that time, who was in threat of being taken over by the Assyrians. So, what sorrow awaits my rebellious children, says the Lord, who make plans that are contrary to mine. You make alliances not directed by my spirit, thus piling up your sins. For without consulting me, you have gone down to Egypt for help. You have put your trust in Pharaoh's protection. You have tried to hide in his shade. But by trusting Pharaoh, you will be humiliated, and by depending on him, you will be disgraced. For though his power extended to Zoan, and his officials have arrived in Haines, all who trust in him will be ashamed. He will not help you. Instead, he will disgrace you. So we see Hezekiah wanted to make a treaty with Egypt for protection against the Assyrians. And, you know, I wanted to do the same thing. Not Egypt, but I often thought, like, if only I can get him to go see a counselor or this Christian counselor or... I don't know if you know JJ and Jacinta. They were pastors in one of the northern suburb churches. They've gone to the UK now. JJ has an amazing testimony. He was actually, he was a drug dealer at some point. Things were so bad that his wife separated from him. They're together again now, married. But things were so bad that literally when he would come into the room, his youngest son would go to the corner and wet himself. That's how bad things were. And he has this testimony about how God turned them around and restored relationship with his sons and with his wife. And I just thought, if I could just send them to JJ, JJ will sort them out. If I can just send them to this pastor will sort them out. And it's good to go for counseling, obviously. But again, I wanted to place my trust in man more than in God in the situation. And now the same applies to us. You know, we think, you know, the courts will stop what's happening here. The political party will stop what's happening here. If we mobilize, it'll stop what's happening here. So our initial thing is to actually go to people. That's another thing that I learned. And people will play a role, but we must place our trust in God first and not in man. Now, the problem isn't necessarily that he went to Egypt, but God said, without consulting me. So I'm not saying we must do nothing. But first we consult God. First we take it to God. He shows us what to do, and we do then what he tells us to do. The next thing is bring it before God. And this is where it gets serious. This is what it's about. So I'm going to read some more from Isaiah. This is Hezekiah again. So Hezekiah had received... the Syrian army was camped outside Jerusalem. Hezekiah had received a letter from the captain of the Syrian army saying, listen here, who do you think you are? Do you think you can stand against the Syrian army? And who do you think your God is? Did the gods of the people we conquered, did they protect them? Neither will your God protect you. So Hezekiah, what he does is, I'm going to read from Isaiah 37, verse 14. After Hezekiah received the letter from the messengers and read it, he went up to the Lord's temple and spread it out before the Lord. He literally took the letter, went to the temple and spread it out there before the Lord. Where are we? And Hezekiah prayed this prayer before the Lord. O Lord of heaven's armies, God of Israel, you are enthroned between the mighty cherubim. You alone are God of all the kingdoms of the earth. You alone created the heavens and the earth. Bend down, O Lord, and listen. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. Listen to Sennacherib's word of defiance against the living God. It is true, Lord, that the king of Syria has destroyed all the nations, and they have thrown the gods of these nations into the fire and burned them. But of course the Assyrians could destroy them. They were not gods at all, only idols of wood and stone shaped by human hands. Now, O Lord, our God, rescue us from his power. Then all the kingdoms of the earth will know that you, O Lord, are God. So I've had to kind of, let's go to Esther first. No, Esther again didn't run to the king's court the moment she heard about this. For 3 days, they fasted and prayed, and they brought this before the Lord. And then she went to the king. And how much different would it have been if she'd just gone straight to the king? Sorry, just to go one back. After this, the Lord went and killed 185,000 soldiers of the army of the Assyrians that was camped outside Jerusalem, and they all went back to Assyria. So God actually took care of this problem because he is God. So back to Esther. You know, it's funny how Esther played this in a sense. You know, she invites the king to a banquet. She doesn't ask him for anything. She invites him to come dine with her. They have a banquet, have a great time. She doesn't tell him what she wants. She invites him back for another banquet the next day. And then after they've eaten, she says to the king what to do. Now, obviously, this is a strategy received from God. Now, if she just, like I say, just ran in there and said, listen, these people are taking, this man wants to take out my people. You must do something about this. She would have been Queen Vashti in like 20 seconds. But she went, took it to God first. And because she took it to God, God worked in the king's heart and God showed her what to do. So again, when we're faced with these things, I'm not saying we mustn't do anything, but we pray first and then let God show us what to do, like God showed Esther what to do. And this whole spreading out the letter thing, I've had a few cases where like I would receive a message from my sister of what something really nasty that her husband sent to her. And again, my initial reaction would be to react. And sometimes I did react, and I'd get onto like a long fight with him on WhatsApp about this. And I've learned to spread out WhatsApps before the Lord, not letters. But literally, that I've learned that don't react. You know, whatever news it is you're getting in my case, whether it's news of what's happening with my family, news of what's happening in this country, don't react. Take it before God. And you know what? The times I reacted, I felt fearful, I felt anxious, I felt really struggled to try and control the situation, and I felt despondent. And every time I got these messages, I felt despondent. But every time I took it to the Lord, I came out like, I'm ready to fight now, not fight with people, but this is not what God's will is for my family. I came out, I went in like desperate and despondent, and I came out wanting to kick somebody's butt. That's how I came out. And that's God stirring me up and strengthening me because I took it to him. And he shows me I am God. I'm God over the situation. Next is I learned to stand on his word. Now, again, Renaud and Leon almost hijacked my sermon here with the words they brought. But like Leon said, sometimes all we're called to do is to stand and stand on his word. And again, we're called for a time such as this to stand and to stand on his word and to stand for against what's happening. Now, the tricky thing about standing on his word is knowing his word. Because sometimes we assume certain promises. We can assume certain promises about this country. We may have a certain idea of what does God coming through for this country look like. And a lot of people think that means removing Zuma. Let's be straight here. But you know what? That's not necessarily what God's going to do. That's not necessarily what God coming through for this country is going to look like. So we must be careful what we stand on. Also, you know, I must be careful as well, you know. God didn't say that my brother and sister won't divorce. That he'll prevent that. Maybe they will divorce. Maybe they'll get back together later. I must be very careful about what I stand on. So what I do stand on is what I do know, which is not in doubt, which is the word of God, that you can stand on always. Because we're all human, and we all sometimes hear things that we like to hear. I mean, maybe don't raise your hands, but how many people here have thought that you've heard, this is the person I'm going to marry, and it turns out it wasn't? I've had that happen to me. Third time lucky, though, but... we all sometimes hear wrong, so we must be careful what we actually stand on. So to stand on the Word of God, you need to know the Word of God. You need to get in here and know what God's promises are. You can't stand on His Word if you don't know His Word. It's just logical. And what I love about what happens is a few times I've had visions of life as this big tapestry, and the whole of creation and our individual lives is a big tapestry. Like, that's where I was born, and that's where I'm going to die. And hopefully I'm only about here now. So, and this is what I see. I can see this. I can see a little bit of what happened in the past, not so clearly because I'm not right there, but I remember some of it. Don't really know what's going to happen there. But God sees the whole thing. So back here, if this is where Esther was and his decree was issued, then this is where God removed Queen Vashti. This is where he established Esther as queen. So God sees the whole tapestry. He wasn't like walking along and, what's happening here? God, like, he knew this was going to happen. So back there, he already made a plan to address what's going to happen here. The problem is we don't see that. We see what's happening here. And that's true for this country. You know, we're like, what's happening in this country? What's happening in the government? God's not surprised by this. And God's been putting things in place which we don't see, which we don't know about. But he's been working to get to this place already. And God reminded me about this with my sister and her husband as well, because I was praying to him about this one day, and he took me back to the day they got married. And when they got married, I was actually in America at the time, and I came back for the wedding, but my sister didn't know I was going to come back. I wanted to surprise her. So because she didn't know I was coming back, she wanted, like, she asked the Duomini to contact me to give them a word for the for the wedding day, like a scripture. And I got there and they pretty much preached exactly what I told him to preach. But God reminded me, like, the one thing that the word I gave was 1 Corinthians 13 and what love is, and that love is actually to choose to love somebody even when you don't feel like it. And God reminded me, said, this is where they are now. They need to choose to love again. They don't feel any love for each other anymore. But back then when they got married, I knew it was going to happen here. I'm not caught off guard by this. I've been working, I've been putting things in place since then. So we must trust in God who sees the big picture. And also, like I say, it's not always going to play out the way we want it to play out. So for instance, the whole decree that was issued, we would think naturally the best thing for God to do was to prevent that decree calling for the destruction of the Jews to be issued in the first place. But because that was issued, actually, God was able to put the Jews in a position to actually get rid of their enemies. If that decree hadn't been issued, Israel would at this point still have to live with their enemies and still be in danger of their enemies. Because that decree was issued for their destruction, they were able to free themselves of their enemies. So sometimes we see something, and it's maybe this cabinet reshuffle. Maybe we think this is a terrible thing. Maybe that's what needed to happen for something else to happen. We must trust that God is in control and that he sees the whole picture and we don't. Other thing God taught me is about having peace in the storm. And we all know the story of Jesus and his disciples in the boat, and they were off across the Sea of Galilee again, I believe, and a big storm came up and Jesus was sleeping, and they're waking up like, Jesus, we're drowning. And he speaks to the storm and says, be still, and the storm calms down. So what I learned from this is there will be storms. Sometimes we think God in control means there's no storms. But there will be storms, so it's important that we have the right expectation. You know, God doesn't promise us that life will be easy. He says, in this world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. If we have that expectation, we're going to be fine. If we have the expectation that nothing bad is ever going to happen to us, we're not going to ever trust that God is good or in control. A big thing God taught me is, you know, the Bible says that God sets the boundaries of the waves and of the sea. And at one point, things were going really, there was one specific weekend where things were going really rough. And I also felt God say to me, listen to me, you stand on me, I'm the rock, and I set the boundaries of the waves. But you know what? You are going to get wet. You know, the waves won't overcome you. Your boat won't sink if I'm in the boat. But you're going to get wet and you're going to get uncomfortable. So often what we do is we get wet and we think we're drowning. And we're actually just getting wet. We're actually just getting sprayed. So those are a few of the things that God has spoken to me about. And before I continue, you can just stay on this slide for now. Like I say, I'm kind of mid-testimony on this at the moment. So I've just asked a couple of people to actually share their testimony who've gone through it and come out the other end. So I'm going to just hand over to first Jamie Lee.
Hello. I think some of you were here, I think, in the beginning of the year when I shared my testimony. Mine is a lot about God being in control. My parents got divorced 4 years ago now. But 4 years ago, just before the divorce, it was very hectic. I won't go into the details, but it was a very, very messy divorce. My dad almost throttled my mom. It was really hectic. And in that hecticness of the Lord said to me, he gave me a promise of restoration. And I was like, I don't know how you're going to restore. And if you're going to restore, what is it going to look like? In any case, my parents did get divorced. Nothing happened then. God didn't restore then. But the Lord told me after that, I am promising restoration. That's what I've said. And in my own, I took it on myself and I was like, okay, now what do I have to do? I have to pray enough. I have to fast. I have to try and make it work. And the Lord said to me so clearly, it's not your burden to carry. I promised it. I'm the one who fulfilled the promise. And then this at the beginning of this year, which is the 2nd of January, which is my parents' original wedding date, they got remarried. And the Lord did a massive restoration. At home this holiday, it was the first time in our entire lives that we actually speak through things and share and cry and whatever. But I'm just God is so in control. He gave me a word. It wasn't my responsibility to fulfill it. And it didn't look like I tried to get control of it. And I tried to talk to my dad and I tried to talk to my mom because I thought, okay, I must fix it now because I tried to be the parent in the situation. But only in the end did I realize that I had never had control over the situation. I could have never had control. Even if I tried to take control, I would have just made it worse. Because firstly, I'm just the child. And God is the father, and he takes control, and he sorts it out. And if he promises to do something, he's going to do it. Because he's faithful and he's true. It's who he is.
Thanks, Jamie. And Kathleen.
Cool. Okay, my story relates a lot to the tapestry, where God actually sees what's coming ahead and has already set the stuff in place. It relates to a work testimony. So I was in a time where I was looking to change jobs. And there was this one company I really had my heart set on going to work there. And I actually kept my eye open the whole time, is there not opportunity or an opening? And I was actually praying about an opening there. That I was asking God, make it possible for me to go and work there. But it wasn't happening. And in the meantime, something else came along in a similar line, but somewhere else. And so I said, okay, cool. This looks good. I prayed about it. I felt I must go for it, and they offered me the job. And then the funny thing happened is 2 days later, this other place I really wanted to go to phoned me, and they said, "Listen, we've got this this position, this program we want you to manage. Are you keen? Will you come?" And I was like, "I've just signed a contract at this other place, you know, and I'm loyal, I won't, you know, if I've signed a contract somewhere else, I won't change my mind. And it sounds strange, like, oh, maybe I missed the Lord and didn't hear properly because it's 2 days late, but God was fully in control there. I reckon if that other contract had come a week later, the other one would have also come 2 days after a week later. He was making sure. And then I went into and it was great in the beginning, but some things started getting a little bit wild and a little bit hectic at this place I was working at. I'm not going to share details, but it was intense. It was rough. The waves were high. It was really, really rough, and a lot of things were coming against me and stuff. And I was like, what do I do? The Lord sent me here, but yes, I actually just want to get out of here. And I actually still spoke to my sister once, and she said, Kathleen, just run. Just get out of there as quickly as you can. And I was like, I went to the Lord, and then I was like, no, I don't go until God sends me away, until he says the time here is up. And then I had to make a decision in that time to actually draw near to the Lord and make a, despite what was going on in the emotions and circumstances, to actually make a faith decision to trust that he's good and that he is in control. And I really learned there that trusting that God's good and he's in control is not putting on a brave face and like, oh, walking around saying, I am blessed, but it's actually drawing closer to him, but then releasing, like Etienne shared, bringing it to the Lord, actually bringing those emotions to the Lord, bringing those fears to the Lord, bringing that anger to the Lord, but then working through it with him in that place of intimacy with him. And then you're able to walk out in that confidence and that peace, knowing everything's going to be okay. And so I actually stopped fighting what was going on and just resting in that peace of the Lord. And it was amazing, because then it got worse. Because shortly after that, I actually got retrenched from there, and I went into the start of a December with absolutely no work and no money. But it was amazing. 2 days after I'd got retrenched from that place, somehow, I don't know how, through the God grapevine, word got to this original place I wanted to go work at that I'm now without work, and they had not filled that position in the whole 6 months. And so then they phoned me and said, oh, we hear that you don't have work. We'd still like you to come and do this, manage this program. And so I was like, yeah, of course. And that was very exciting. I was like, I knew God is so in control of what's going on. But then it was still like about a 2-month process, because funnily enough, the big boss there actually didn't want me. The other lady did, and there were some awesome divine interventions as well there, which actually 2 months later ended up me getting the job and being an awesome 3-year career, part of the many careers. But it was just so incredible for me looking back how I had to actually go through that 6 months of hell at the other place, because there was so much flaws in my character and things that the Lord actually worked in me in that time. He worked so much in my relationship with him in my time. He established a no turning back place of trust in him during that time. So it's actually, as horrible and stormy and wet as it was, I'm so glad that I was there, because so much happened. I learned so much in that time of how in control he really is, and how to bring these situations to him, and that I can trust him. As he had, just one more, how he saw the tapestry, that the job that took me 2 months to eventually get the big boss to agree to, they made me do a presentation for the final decision, and it was on a topic that I'd been Holy Spirit led to a couple of years back to discover, which no one in South Africa actually knew about yet. And I'd then researched it and studied it and started doing work with it. And then I had to then do the presentation to get this other job on that topic, and that won them over. So like 6 years back, the Lord had already actually orchestrated everything. So it's just so amazing how actually in control he really is. We have no idea what he sees ahead. So I'm excited for what more is in the tapestry.
So basically, if you've been drifting off at all, this is what it comes down to. I was driving one day, and again, something flare-up had happened. And I was calling out to God about this, not in a very confident way, like almost a begging, desperate way. And God said one thing to me: either I am God or I am not. And it really comes down to that. It's really that simple. Because if he is God, then he's in control. And if he's not, he's not. So it reminds me of Elijah, who was challenging the prophets of Baal back in the day. You know the story where they both had to put offerings to their gods and ask their gods to bring fire to consume the offering. Obviously, the Baal prophets, they were cutting themselves and going crazy for like the whole day and nothing happened. And then God brought fire and consumed the offering that was made to him. But what happened at this time, the Israelites, it's not like they weren't following God. They were following God, but also Baal. They were worshiping God and Baal. Now, we think today it's stupid, because how could you worship some odd statue? We don't have that anymore, but we trust in God, but we also trust in our political systems. We trust in God plus this, plus that. We hedge our bets, in a sense. And what Elijah said to them is, decide today, if God is God, then follow him. If Baal is Baal, then follow him. And that's what, God didn't exactly say that to me, but he said to me, either I'm God or I'm not. And it's really that simple. Like, we try and complicate it, like God plus this, God, but we must do that. But either he's God or he's not. And if he's God, then we can stand on his word. His word says that I work out all things to the good of those who love me and according to my purposes. It means he's going to work out what's happening in my sister and her husband's life to their good. He's going to work out what's happening in this country for the good of this country. So it's basically, when confronted with these situations, the question we've got to ask ourselves is he God or is he not God? And it's really that straightforward. So what I want us to do now is, I just want to give opportunity that if there's any situations that you're facing, whether it's this country, what's happening in this country, whether it's something personal, I actually want you, if you want to come lay it before God now, as Hezekiah laid that letter before God, lay it before God and say to him, you are God over this. So maybe the worship band can come up and just play a bit for us. I'm going to give opportunity, you can come to the front. We're not actually going to pray with you. I just want you to come lay it before God and just come say to him, you are God over this. Thank you.